Welcome back to another episode of the Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix, and we have a special double guest episode for you today. There's been a lot of activity since last Thursday's trade deadline. The Cleveland Cavaliers have reloaded, and the Golden State Warriors were dealt a potentially tough blow with the recent injury to Kevin Durant. We'll dive into all that and more with Bobby Marks, the front office insider over at the Vertical. And it's March, which means NCAA tournament time. Jonathan Givony from Draft Express will be here to talk about what he expects to see from some of the top prospects and who could make a pretty strong impression with their play this month. All that and more next, the Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix. All right, before we get to Bobby Marks, quick housekeeping note. If you're on iTunes and you're listening to this podcast there, please give us a rating, post a comment there. That always helps this podcast and keeping it going for the long term. So check it out. Comments, ratings, all appreciated. Positive comments, of course, only are appreciated the most. Let's bring in Bobby Marks, the most positive guy I know, front office insider over at the Vertical. Bobby, not a great... a day for positivity, especially out in Golden State, huh? I mean, the news breaking Wednesday morning, East Coast time, with Kevin Durant expected to be out about a month, if not longer. And, you know, listening to Bob Myers and reading the quotes from him today, you know, they say in a month, but you get a sense that this might be a little bit longer. You know, Bob's saying that, you know, long-term, the prognosis is good. Short-term, we'll see what happens. I mean, it's not exactly a ringing endorsement from an executive, but a player coming back and being 100% this season.
Chris, the worst news could have been if this happened mid-May and, you know, you're in a Western Conference Finals and Durant would go down, and then even if you had gotten advanced, then you probably wouldn't have had him for the finals. So we're in early March right now, and the bone bruises are tricky, though. You just never know from a healing standpoint as far as when a player can return. And I still see them holding on here for one. You know, I know San Antonio's, I think, four back, three in a loss column. But you're going to need Curry and Thompson to really step up now. Draymond, step up. You know, you can't have nights like you had in Washington a couple nights ago here, or even some nights in Philadelphia where they were able to hold on. But this team, it certainly opens up the level as far from the West, but this team is still a very good team right now.
Yeah, they're still strong, and they go from four All-Stars to three, which is something anybody would be envious of still. But it is funny to note that San Antonio, like you said, is three games back in that loss column. And, you know, they have three games left with Golden State. Two of them are at home, and San Antonio has the most heavy home schedule of any team in the NBA that's left over. This, to me, is an opportunity for the Spurs to leapfrog Golden State, especially if they can get two out of three from the Warriors in the rest of these matchups.
It will be interesting, especially if it's the number one seed is there for the taking, because you know how San Antonio has rested players. Oh, yeah. They've staggered minutes as far as what the priority will be as far as keeping your players fresh or going for that number one seed. You'd like to have the best of both worlds there, but I don't see them, you know, playing guys back-to-back, you know, heavy minutes if that's what's on the line here. I think it's more important when you get to mid-April and you're the number two seed and, you know, you've got to play in Oklahoma City. And that's the difference, Chris, right there is one and two. You know, one is you're going to get either probably Denver, Portland, maybe Dallas, I guess. And if you're two, I mean, you're going to get OKC, Memphis. Those are your two teams there, which is that's a major dogfight.
You know, here's my question though. And I'd even look ahead even further and assume they win that first round series. If I'm San Antonio, who am I most comfortable playing against in that second round? Is it a healthy Houston team or a potentially healthy Clippers team? And we haven't seen a healthy Clippers team for a while. They're getting their guys back. And let's not forget, when they started the season, they were 14-2 with that group. They were, you know, the best team in basketball for a little while when they had all their guys fully healthy. I think San Antonio, you have to almost wonder, what's the better matchup for them? Is it the Rockets and their offense, or is it a completely loaded Clipper team that is obviously playing with a sense of desperation?
Well, and speaking of that Clipper team, now here's their window right now. you know, where, based on where, you know, when Durant would return. And even if he did return, let's say right before the playoffs started, it, you know, still will take him a little bit to get going and maybe get some of that rust off. But a team that's always been snake bit, from bad losses, that Houston series a couple of years ago, to losing guys like Chris Paul and Blake Griffin in the first round versus Portland last year. Now, is this their window right now where maybe you get a not fully strong Golden State team, possibly in the second round? But I mean, they'd have to get past Utah or Memphis or Oklahoma City in the first round. So, but this could be their one opportunity for a team that is going to have a lot of question marks when it gets to the offseason. That if they, I mean, can you imagine that if Golden State rolled out a team without Durant and you still lose to that team in the second round? I mean, how do you come back in the offseason and, you know, when spend $150 million in payroll with some of these players and having a good but not great team?
Yeah, that'd be tough. That'd be tough for Steve Ballmer to swallow. I know he's always willing to put up money if he feels it's going towards, you know, the right type of team. But, you know, you're right. If they lose in that second round to a hobbled or battered Golden State team, that might change his perception. But with the Warriors, you know, you mentioned San Antonio and how they never go all out for seeding. They'll rest guys. They won't play Tony Parker on some back-to-back situations. Manu Ginobili, same thing. You might see, you know, the entire lineup sit out for a game or two down the stretch. At the same time, though, you know, if you're Golden State and your depth has already taken a pretty big hit this offseason when you lost Barnes and you lost Bogut, I mean, how aggressive do you get with your guys to keep that number one seed? Because with Durant out, you probably have to extend the minutes of guys like Curry and Thompson and Green to win some games. And, you know, I know they're much younger than San Antonio's guys, but is there not a danger there in overextending them in the regular season?
No, you're right, because now you'll see, you know, Iguodala's minutes probably increase a little bit. You'll see Livingston's minutes increase. Can you get something out of Ian Clark or Patrick McCaw? You know, they'll sign Matt Barnes here for the rest of the season. So that gives you a different dimension there. So at least you're able to pick up a player towards the end of the year and give you a little bit of a break there. But, you know, when you look at both teams' schedules down the stretch here, you know, going into Wednesday, you know, Golden State had 22 left, 12 home, 10 on the road, 12 of those are below teams 500. But if you look at San Antonio, I mean, they've got 16 home and 8 on the road. Mm-hmm. It's a big difference there. I mean, playing at home, there's nothing better than playing at home, and you have that a little bit of a cushion there. So I think if you are going to see San Antonio get on a run to catch them, get, you know, their three back in the loss column as of Wednesday, it's going to be based on how the schedule shakes out.
Yeah, it got a lot more interesting in the West, no question. And in the East too. I mean, if you're Cleveland waking up today, you've got to feel a little bit better about your chances as repeating as champions, not just because of the Durant injury, but, you know, it seems to me, Bobby, they addressed every need that they had over the last couple of days. Deron Williams comes in, and no, he's not the Deron Williams that you had in Brooklyn or the guy that was in Utah, but he's certainly an upgrade over Kay Felder and can give you most of what Matthew Dellavedova gave them in the past, maybe more if you're talking about playing him against second line guys. And Andrew Bogut is, you know, a bona fide center who can rebound and has championship experience that, you know, all of a sudden is a better version of Timothy Mozgov from last year. I mean, you know, all the drama that impacted Cleveland, and this is all assuming that Kevin Love comes all the way back and is healthy in time for the stretch run. You know, all the drama in Cleveland seems to have just vanished. I mean, these look like just what the doctor ordered there for the Cavs.
Well, Chris, and that's why I never bought into what LeBron, you know, preached back in, I guess that was early January after some of those Monday losses where, you know, he questioned management, you know, as far as, you know, for adding players or through the trade deadline or assigning players, and, you know, basically how, you know, he questioned, you know, David Griffin and their group here, because you knew reinforcements were on the way, because if they didn't make a deal at the deadline and they couldn't based on, you know, where their assets were, you knew they were going to pick up players, you know, with this March 1 waiver buyout here. And you add Deron Williams, who is best suited right now in this stage of his career to come off the bench and give you 20 to 25 minutes, almost like that Zach Randolph role down in Memphis, where, you know, Zach has really, you know, taken to, you know, coming off the bench there with Jamichael Green. And with Bogut, a little bit different. He's been more injured this year. He's an extra big that you weren't going to find if you signed him off, find a guy in a D League or a player coming back overseas. And you get both guys who are battle tested, Bogut playing in the finals, a couple years in a row. Darren's played in a lot of big games, you know, in Utah and even in Brooklyn. You know, that Brooklyn team went to the playoffs 3 years in a row there. And you didn't have to give up anything. The only added cost is a little bit in tax money because both guys are signed for, you know, the prorated minimum.
Is this what Deron Williams kind of is moving forward? I mean, he's 32. He's going to be 33 by the time next season starts. I mean, are his days as a starter behind him now? I mean, is he just a pretty high level backup? Not that there's anything wrong with that. I mean, you know, he could probably have a productive, you know, 4 or 5 years if he accepts that. But is this kind of where we're at with Deron Williams, where, you know, he's just a steady insurance policy?
I think it is, Chris. I think he could start certainly on a not a playoff, worthy team here. If that's the direction he wants to go in the offseason when he's a free agent, but he's got a lot of miles on his leg. As you mentioned, his age, he is at a point in his career where really money is not a factor. He's made a lot of money in with that Brooklyn contract. He made a lot of money.
Yes, he'll thank you for that. Yes.
he's on one of those, and he's still getting paid. I mean, you got to look at it. He's still getting paid by Brooklyn, you know, a little over $5 million a year for the next few years here. So that's not an issue. I think for Darren, it will be with, you know, regarding his family as far as finding the best situation for him there. But from a playing standpoint, if he is accepts the role, coming off your bench, plays 25 minutes, I think I can see his body maybe holding up almost to like where Vince is right now. You know, we see Vince Carter at a level where, I mean, he's still playing. He's not the Vince Carter of 2000, but he's still a productive player coming off the bench here. And if Darren accepts that role, I think he could be a very good backup. And he can also play with your point guard. You know, you could play the two of them together.
Yeah, and Vince, you know, to his credit, understood when he was no longer a star. He knew that to hang around in the league, he had to accept a role player role. And we've seen that a million times, Bobby, where guys just can't do it. I mean, Allen Iverson is the most high profile example of that over the last 10 plus years. But I mean, there are countless examples of guys thinking that, you know, I'm still an alpha male. I'm still a star. Why would I ever think I'm a backup? And Vince Carter is more the exception than the rule. From what you know about, you know, Deron Williams' personality, his temperament, I mean, is he the kind of guy that you think would accept a lesser role that would keep him around for, you know, 5-6 more years?
I do, you know, and it's funny, Chris, when I look back at the years in Brooklyn and his, he had his first year there, and when we moved to Brooklyn, he had CJ Watson as his backup, certainly a quality backup, and Darren had battled some injuries, and CJ started, and I think Darren came off the bench, you know, when he was recovering from that. The following year, we had Sean Livingston, almost the same situation. Darren had some injuries. And then the third year was Jarrett Jack, all three guys who are certainly, you know, who have started, you know, throughout the league. So there's been a pattern there in the past, you know, more of when Darren was in the prime of his career. But now we fast forward 3 or 4 years later. And the one thing was always about his body holding up. There was always an injury, either a calf injury or an ankle injury or a wrist injury that would limit him, you know, 15, 20 games, you know, that he would lose during the year. But when your minutes go down, where, you know, in Cleveland here is that we've got, you know, 20, 25 games left. There certainly will be a role. It's almost going to be like just getting ready for the playoffs. This is almost like an audition period as far as where you can kind of mix and match your lineups.
Yeah. I mean, they just, you know, this is exactly what they needed. You know, those two guys, Bogut and Williams, they upgrade the bench. They give them some versatility. Veterans that have played, as you said, at a high level. I mean, it just makes all the nonsense we talked about for the last 2 months seem completely inconsequential. It's tough for those Eastern Conference contenders that are out there that, you know, look, they were seeing some vulnerability there. They sensed a little bit of blood in the water. I think that's why, you know, Toronto was as aggressive as they were going out and getting Serge Ibaka and, you know, acquiring PJ Tucker from Phoenix. And, you know, Boston, they were looking around at a few different things to make themselves better. And Washington has made themselves better. They get Bogdanovic, and now they signed Brandon Jennings, you know, to be a backup point guard up there, upgrading their bench significantly. Are any of these three teams that I mentioned, do you consider them now? I mean, are they real threats? I mean, who has got the best chance of stepping into a seven-game series with the Cavs and maybe giving them a run?
Well, I think, Chris, we got to see how Kyle Lowry recovers from, you know, from his wrist surgery here. And, you know, you've got new faces there with Tucker and Ibaka. But for them, you know, can you get that it's all about seeding. You know, you might see Cleveland in the second round and not in the Eastern Conference Finals if they can't get past Washington or Boston. And I think, you know, looking back on the trade deadline, I'm sure Danny Ainge had this in his mind that why am I going to risk all my assets for a Jimmy Butler or Paul George when a Cleveland team can go out and sign a Deron Williams or an Andrew Bogut? You know, why am I going to do that? Maybe if there was never a March 1 waiver buyout, and there was a freeze on when players can be signed, you know, day after the trade deadline, then yeah, maybe Danny would have been a little more aggressive. But when you have, this is almost like a second free agent period that we have right now. When you know that Cleveland has reinforcements come up, and we haven't even talked about how Deron Williams has played there.
Yeah.
I mean, he's played, I mean, incredible, because he's got there's a role for him there. And, you know, that's why you had to gauge last week how vulnerable this Cleveland team was and not be as aggressive. And I do like what Washington did with Bogdanovic. He played really well against Golden State. Now you've got Brandon Jennings coming here. You can play him off the ball if you had to. And especially with Toronto, we talked about. But I mean, this Cleveland team, I mean, they're loaded. I mean, J.R. Smith's not back yet and Kevin Love's not back. I mean, when you add those guys, and I know you can only play five at a time, but there's going to be roles for everyone here.
And Kyle Lowry's injury hurts Toronto. You know, hopefully he'll be back in time for the end of the regular season, get some reps in so he can be ready for a potential second round matchup there. But that's the team I looked at. I mean, I've watched a couple of games with Serge Ibaka in the lineup, and the defensive versatility that he gives Dwayne Casey completely changes them. Brad Stevens said the other day that it's like, in some ways, a totally different team out there defensively because of what Ibaka can do. Put him at the five, play him at the four, play him alongside Valanciunas or away from him. I mean, he, you know, who knows how well he's going to be able to play down the stretch and if he's really willing to embrace being a supporting guy again. But if he is, and if Lowry's back, that's a team that can be really scary because of how they can match up and how well that backcourt has played all season.
Chris, you know what they got? They got tougher.
Yeah.
They got tougher with PJ Tucker and they got tougher with Ibaka. Those two additions, they give that team a different mindset. And we talked about it a couple weeks ago before they did that Ibaka deal, that team became too predictable with, you know, Lowry and DeRozan. And I mean, you basically knew how the end of the game was going to be. And as good as DeRozan's as a one-on-one player, an ISO player, but now you add, you can do different lineups when you roll out there. You can put Ibaka at the five if you had to, or you can even leave Valanciunas out there at times. And it gives you a little bit of a different twist when you're not rolling out Terrence Ross or Patrick Patterson. Now those guys, Ross is in Orlando, but you know, Patterson can come off your bench here and you went from a, you know, ball dominant team to you've got a, you know, a little bit of an identity right now.
Yeah. I mean, I thought without Williams and without Bogut, you know, the Cavaliers were open to a potential upset. Open to. I wouldn't make them an underdog against anybody in the Eastern Conference, but, you know, a turned ankle there, a couple of bad games here or there. There was an opportunity for some teams out there. Now, not so much. But, you know, another team on the outside kind of looking in that's played good basketball of late is Atlanta. And Atlanta's coming off a win at Boston, and the Hawks, you know, I know it was a tough call for them to decide to retain their guys to go out and try to be buyers instead of sellers to keep Paul Millsap on the roster. But it looks like, you know, they're at least a threat, Bobby, to get to the conference finals. Probably not if they're in that 4-5 slot because they'll inevitably lose to the Cavaliers, who they can't touch in the postseason, haven't for the last couple of years. But what do you make of the decision of Atlanta to keep this group together and just try to push forward with these players?
I agree with it. You know, it's hard to, you know, you weren't going to move Howard likely and Schroeder because of, you know, both guys being signed, and he had just signed Kent Bazemore to a really big contract, and Millsap would have been your asset, and losing him and an all NBA and all-star level player, you know, who was that next player to kind of step up? I mean, were you going to rely on, you know, Mike Muscala there? So I understand it. It's hard when you're the coach is the head of basketball operations to make a decision like that, where you're letting, you know, a player like Millsap's caliber in midseason. Maybe it would help 2 years from now. But, you know, it will be interesting because right now they're in two games behind four. I've seen some good things with some of their young players, the Torian Princes. You know, he's starting to get some minutes there. The Ilyasova, I think, move was certainly underrated, under the radar with Philadelphia, where you had to give up, you know, 2 second-round picks. He'll certainly come off the bench and help you out there. But it's so hard, Chris, hitting a reset button. And I think even if they did hit the reset, they would have made the playoffs. But you know, but who are you going to fill or sign? Do you have a comfort level in free agency as far as who that player was going to be that you could resign? And I think that's where the big question in Atlanta was.
Yeah, and they're going to have to make a decision. I mean, they've clearly made the decision, I guess, with Millsap, and that they're going to go out there and they're going to sign him. He just turned 32. I mean, man, they're going to have to pay him a lot of money, aren't they? I mean, he's probably going to get $20+ million, right, in the open market.
He's the second best power forward on the market. When you look at Blake Griffin, you look at Millsap, you look at Serge Ibaka. But yeah, he is, and he's shown that he's been, Millsap has shown that he's been durable here, and he's going to opt out of, you know, $21-22 million. So you're at least looking to make that back up and maybe attach some years to it, maybe 3 or 4 years. And Chris, that's going to be the trend with a lot of these free agents this summer, is that there's a lot of these players. You look at Chris Paul and Kyle Lowry, players like that, who, you add years on their contract and they're going to be making a lot of money when they're 33, 34 years old here. And that's the hard part from a front office, from a general manager's point, that you always reward a player based on prior success. And it's hard predicting out as far as where the future might lie, because it's for, you know, shifting gears a little bit, for a player like Chris Paul, it's hard to sustain this when he's, you know, 34, 35 years old.
Yeah. And my issue with Atlanta making this decision is just, I don't know how you supplement this roster over the next couple of years to make it a true, you know, conference contender. I mean, Millsap is not going to get better over the next couple of years. Dwight Howard is not going to get better. Schroeder's going to get better, presumably. And he has, I think, some star potential, you know, at least all-star potential in him. But everybody else, I mean, is Kent Bazemore suddenly going to emerge as an even better player than he is today? Is, you know, are one of their, they're going to have to hit on draft picks, but, and those guys are going to take some time to develop. I mean, you're talking about a front court that's in its 30s. And if you had an opportunity to trade one of them and get real assets back in return, even if it is only 75 cents or so on the dollar, I don't know, man. I mean, I know it's a tough call for a president and a head coach to make. Like you said, it's a tough call for any organization to make, to kind of hit the reset button. But, you know, as we saw with Boston, sometimes it's better to do that. Sometimes it makes the most sense to cut your losses when you're a pretty good team and rebuild so that you don't slowly, you know, devolve into a really bad team. And Boston, what they did is put them in the position they're in now. I just don't think, Bobby, the next couple of years that Atlanta's going to be in, you know, anything more than what they are today.
Well, and that's the difference between Boston and Atlanta. It's not like Boston is just waiting there, almost playing the waiting game for Cleveland to hopefully get a little bit older, maybe have an injury here and there, and maybe they can sustain them, overcome them based on what they do this summer and all those assets there. That's not the situation in Atlanta. I mean, basically, if you sign Millsap, that's your big free agent there, and you'll have a draft pick and whatever exception, but you'll return basically the whole core of this group here. You have to sign Hardaway or maybe bring back Ilyasova. Who knows what will happen with Cephalosha. So it's not like you have a Brooklyn pick for this year, next year, or a Memphis pick, or $30 million in cap space to go out and get maybe Gordon Hayward or Blake Griffin or one of these other players. Atlanta doesn't have the flexibility that Boston does. So if you think that they're the next team up that can challenge Cleveland, they're not. They're, it's clearly Boston. What happens in Toronto this summer with Ibaka and Tucker with their free agency and Lowry? And also, you know, we can put Washington up there with that backcourt.
Yeah, and eventually Milwaukee's going to get there if Jabari comes back. And there's just, they're just in this weird state of limbo right now that I thought it would have made more sense for them to blow it up and start this thing all over again from scratch. If they could get something real in exchange for Millsap, and maybe even down the road, Dwight Howard, if you can trade him in the offseason. All right, a couple of things I want to get to is, you know, in Boston, Al Horford's taking a lot of heat right now. He has not played well over the last couple of weeks, and everyone is kind of pointing out that, is this really what we're getting with a $113 million contract? Now, Bobby, look, the last 2 weeks are kind of indefensible for Al. He has not played well. He hasn't shot the ball well. He's been a non-factor in the fourth quarter of games, but overall, his numbers are kind of what they were in Atlanta. He's averaging 14 points right now, averaged 15 last year. He's averaging 6.5 rebounds, averaged about 7 last year in Atlanta. His shooting percentage has dipped. It's under 50% for the first time since really his rookie year. So that's a net negative. But, you know, I think sometimes the Boston fans had it in their head that they were getting a superstar in Al Horford. He's not. This is who he is. He is a solid scorer, a decent but not great rebounder, and a good team defender. He was never going to be this second star, so to speak, to put on this team. They're always going to need somebody else. They overpaid for him, but everybody was going to overpay for him at that point. Atlanta was, Washington was. I just think some, you know, people in Boston need to recognize that, you know, this is kind of what they signed up for.
Chris, you got a 30-year-old, very good player, and I think that's where, you know, people look at the name, you know, the contract, how much he's earning, and there are different expectations for different players here. And you know, he's not a superstar. I mean, he's not a top 10, I don't think he's a top 10 player, and that's fine, and that's how he's always been in his career. I mean, besides the 1 year where he averaged, you know, 17 points, he's always been around 15. Now he's at 14, and he's a very good, I would say, 1B, you know, maybe even a number 2 complimentary, you know, all-star there. He's not a Kawhi Leonard. He's not a James Harden or Russell Westbrook or any of those type of players. And I think that's where, you know, if you're a fan of the Celtics, that's where you have to look at it. And I think a lot of it has to do with maybe that, you know, maybe they didn't make a move that, you know, they didn't make a move at the trade deadline here with, you know, getting it. And now the expectations well, all right, you know, where Horford or Isaiah has got to have to lead us now. Is this, you know, roster good enough to get past the first round? Because it hasn't been in the past here. But, you know, I don't buy it. I mean, I think he's still a very good player here. Their schedule's been, you know, not very easy either. I know they've had some tough losses and everything, but they'll be fine. This Celtic team will be fine. They'll be the 2 seed. We'll see who they get in that you know, that first round, if it's you know, Chicago or Indiana here. But I've got no worries, because I've always thought about this team. It's a rebuild. It's a rebuild team that's a playoff team, and mm-hmm. and where they were in 2013 to compare it to where they are now and where they're going to be in the future here. The window is not closing soon. You know, maybe on some of these contracts with Isaiah and Avery next summer or even this summer, but there's a lot of longevity to this team.
Yeah, there is. And a lot of options for Danny Ainge to play with, moving forward. It's just that, you know, the expectations for Al, I thought, have always been, you know, just kind of nutty. One thing about Horford, though, I think that needs to be addressed in the future is that you got to move him to power forward. He's just not a 5. He doesn't want to be a 5. He doesn't rebound like a 5. And for this team to be able to consistently stay in games and on the glass and not just get destroyed by the likes of Valanciunas and, you know, the guys in Cleveland, they've got to get another body there. And I think Boston recognizes that. I mean, you know, they've been trying to get Nerlens Noel. They were trying to get Nerlens Noel for like 6 months. I mean, it wasn't a trade deadline thing. They were actively after him for a while. And of course, they talked to Bogut prior to Bogut choosing Cleveland. I think they recognize in Boston that they can't succeed, at least not at the highest of levels, with Horford playing that many minutes at 5. He can play spot duty there, Bobby, but I don't think they can succeed with him being a center full time.
No, I agree. And I think that's, you know, he didn't go to Boston, you know, thinking that he was going to be the starting center for the Celtics here. And I think, you know, that will be the challenge, though, is because if you have him at four, are you comfortable with Amir Johnson at your five? It's almost better if you had put Crowder at the five. Yeah. I mean, from a toughness standpoint. And you know, that's maybe if we look back at the trade deadline, you know, outside of, you know, the home run hitting deals that maybe could have happened for Butler or Paul George, is that, you know, was there a five out there? Was there a Nerlens Noel that maybe you had to sacrifice the Clipper pick and the future Clipper pick or a player there to maybe get there? We don't know about that. And even missing out on Bogut, as injury prone as he has been this year, at least you could put Bogut and Horford on a court at the end of games here. So it will be interesting to watch Boston in the next 6 weeks as far as if Brad, you know, experiments with different lineups down the stretch.
All right, let me finish asking you about the Lakers and Magic Johnson in particular. I've been kind of critical of Magic up until this point, not of what he's done, because I think he has been very good. He's been very proactive and made some good moves. I mean, moving Lou Williams for a first round pick, I think, was smart. Lou has no real place for the Lakers long term, and you know, getting that first round pick is better value for this team, especially with, you know, how they want to finish the season. I mean, they want to lose at this point and get inside that top three and keep that draft pick. But you know, there's been a lot of people out there that have expressed opinions that, you know, because Magic Johnson is Magic Johnson, that he's automatically going to succeed. I mean, you've been in that executive role. I mean, Magic is not the GM, he's the president. But as the president, I mean, how active does Magic need to be on the scouting scene and, you know, in terms of seeing D-League players and traveling to Europe? I mean, what is, you know, he's going to have a guy beneath him and a couple of guys beneath him, a big staff underneath him. But how active does Magic need to be to have success in that position?
You know, Chris, when you work for a front office and you work for a team, you know, it's hard sometimes to kind of come up for air, and he'll do so in August. I mean, but we're in early March right now, and you go from the trade deadline last week. Now we've got, you know, they moved, did the Lou Williams, did now the waiver by Jose Calderon, which was a good move. And now we jump into scouting season, which has been going on for the last, you know, three months here, into the NCAA tournament. Then you've got Portsmouth, and you're still trying to evaluate your own roster for the next 6 weeks. And then from Portsmouth goes to the pre-draft camp and workouts, and then free agency, the draft. And it's a never ending everyday cycle here. And I think that's going to be the biggest adjustment for him, is that it's not a 5 day, you know, week type job. It's 7 days a week, and you're constantly thinking, you know, how to improve this team from a scouting standpoint. And you also have to build out a staff here. And we saw, it hasn't been official yet, but with Rob Pelinka, you know, being hired, which will be good for Magic, just based on a relationship standpoint with, you know, other agents. And Rob's been able to do a lot of different deals, so there's a good negotiator in house there. But you know, they've got to figure out and what for Magic to do is he's got to lay out some principles as far as, and I'm sure he's already done, how his thought process is built to build this team and stick to them. And what they do this summer will be interesting, because they potentially could have some cap space here. And we've got the Paul George, you know, stuff hanging over, and, you know, do you do a lot of 1 year deals and you go from there, and maybe you keep some flexibility, but Chris, this job, I mean, it keeps you up at night. I'm telling you, you know, now I work in the media, I sleep a lot better, because you're always constantly worrying, you know, and it's a little bit different, you know, in season, you're constantly worrying about wins and losses. When are you going to get that next win? Especially if you have a good team. If you go on a losing streak, you're worrying about, you know, who's out at night. Are you going to get a phone call in the middle of the night that something's happened with one of your players? I mean, even look at Bob Myers in Golden State. I mean, that team was, what, 50-9 going into that Washington game, and mm-hmm. then you get Durant go down, and it is not easy to run a franchise, and I think that's why winning is so hard. But with Magic in, you know, in Los Angeles, it's just a 7 day a week grind here, and I think you've got to have a certain pace to how you do so, and it's not all about just jumping into the deep end with 2 feet here, but hire people with specialties around you. It's almost like, you know, you're the president and you're hiring, you know, different cabinet officers, because each person has a specialty there and they can bring you ideas, and then you're the one who will have the final decision there.
Yeah. I mean, look, it's some people have suggested that he's going to have a staff that's going to bring him, are going to do the legwork for him. But the staff, as you know, it's not always going to be on the same page. At some point, the GM is going to disagree with the assistant GM, who's going to disagree with the director of player personnel, who's going to just disagree with the director of college scouting. And you know, ultimately, Magic's going to have to take these opinions and make a decision there. And he can't make that decision unless he's out there. I mean, you know, all the great executives of today, they're constantly at games. They're constantly in Europe. I mean, you know, Giannis Antetokounmpo is the next big star in today's NBA. I mean, he was ID'd in large part because John Hammond, the GM of the Bucks, was over in Greece scouting him and making a determination that, you know, that crappy league that Giannis was playing in was not reflective of his talents overall. I mean, that's the kind of stuff that Magic's going to do. And I'm not saying that he's not going to do it. All I've been saying for the last couple of weeks is that he has to do it. And if he doesn't do it, we are going to see the same, you know, kind of mess that we see in New York, that we see in Sacramento. He can't just sit back and say, you know, I'm Magic Johnson. I've earned this right. I've earned this position through how I played. It's like starting from scratch. It's like basically starting over at an entirely new profession where your playing days mean nothing. Your business acumen means nothing. You have got to go out there and show the work ethic. If he does, being Magic Johnson is going to help him because he already has a natural sense of basketball that most people don't have. And if he combines that with a great work ethic, I think he'd have a ton of success. But if he doesn't, you know, we could see another, you know, Knicks or Kings situation unfold in front of us.
Being Magic Johnson will help on July 1st, Chris, when you are meeting with free agents, or even before that, when you're setting up your meetings. It will not help you on July 3rd when that player makes that decision as far as where he goes, because he's going to pick a spot where winning is more important there. And that's the, you know, that's where the lore of LA and New York is not there anymore. And I think even when you look at with Magic and with building out a staff, you can't have people there who are yes men. You've got to have a staff that can challenge him, that can be a bad guy, can be, you know, more no men, you know, as far as a person who can, you know, really, you know, challenge his thought process there and not always agree as far as what the decision is going to be here. So it will be interesting because we've seen it work in, you know, Larry Bird has been able to do it in Indiana, but, you know, Larry puts a lot of work. I mean, Larry goes out and scouts and, you know, and he's got a set of principles that he, you know, you either agree or disagree on, but he's got a set of principles in how you do so where it's a lot different in New York. I mean, if that's the blueprint to follow, then I think Magic's going to be in for some trouble here.
Yeah. We'll see how that plays out. Bobby, as always, man, I appreciate it. We'll talk very soon, I'm sure.
Thanks, Chris.
You're listening to the Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix.
Hi, boys and girls. It's Tony Kornheiser reminding you to subscribe and listen to my daily podcast, where we talk about everything from sports to politics to the impending animal revolution. And remember, you can listen to new and archived episodes wherever you listen to podcasts, including iTunes, Spotify, and Google Play.
All right, so we're into March, NCAA tournaments, conference tournaments, all sorts of fun stuff in college basketball, and the draft certainly is going to be really compelling this year with the number of teams that, you know, the draft picks that could move, the number of teams that have significant holes, Boston, where could they land in that top mix, and who would they consider at that top spot with that next pick? Talk about that and so much more. Nobody better than Jonathan Givony, draftexpress.com, and John joins me here on the line. How you doing, John?
Doing great, Chris. How are you?
I'm good, man. I appreciate you coming on here. So I want to start at the top of the draft, and you've scouted Fultz and Ball from Washington and UCLA, and you know they're on your board as 1-2 right now. I'm curious, how big a gap is there, if there is one, between a guy like Markelle Fultz and Lonzo Ball? I mean, Fultz has been number one on your board for a while, Ball right at number two. I mean, how big a gap is there between those two players?
I think there's going to be a significant debate between those two and especially Josh Jackson as well. I don't think anything is decided. It's not one of those drafts, you know, where you have a LeBron type figure at the top and it's just, you know, Anthony Davis. And it's just, you know, as soon as a team gets the number one pick, they can basically come out and say, we're taking that guy. I don't think this is one of those drafts. And really, if you talk to different NBA teams, they'll give you, you know, different perspectives on, you know, a lot of them. I would say the majority like Fultz right now, but, you know, Lonzo, you know, he'll have a game like he did on Saturday against Arizona where he just completely controls the tempo of the game and, you know, without putting up huge numbers and, you know, makes shots and distributes and even plays some defense and really makes you wonder if, you know, how locked in Fultz is in that top spot. So I think there's still a lot left to be decided, and there's some talk that Fultz is going to sit out his last two games. We don't know what's going to happen in the conference tournament. You know, he may be shutting it down at this point because he feels, okay, what do I have left to accomplish? Whereas Lonzo, I mean, he could take UCLA to the Final Four, maybe a national championship, and you have to think that's going to weigh very heavily in the minds of NBA decision makers who, you know, their goal at the end of the day is to win basketball games, and Markelle Fultz has not shown that he's capable of doing that in the least bit, while Lonzo Ball has completely transformed UCLA.
So how much do you hold that against him, John, in the sense of evaluating him, that Washington this year just hasn't been very good?
I think it has to be a factor in the conversation, not to be something that's discussed. I mean, every time I've watched Fultz, I felt like he is doing the best with what he has. He looks very frustrated, but he has been trying to compete even when his team is getting blown out. You still try, you know, see him trying to do things. It's not like, you know, that feeling you got with Ben Simmons where he just completely quit on his team, like in that Texas A&M game in the SEC conference tournament, which was, you know, just embarrassing to watch. You haven't gotten that feeling from watching Fultz this year. And so it's hard to hold too much against him, you know, considering just how bad their team is, how poorly coached they are, and how little chance he has to succeed with the guys that are around him. And the Pac-12 is loaded. So it's going to be a really interesting debate because, you know, you hear both sides of it, and you can make a compelling argument going either way.
You mentioned Fultz and Ball and Josh Jackson from Kansas. Is there a drop-off after those three guys? I mean, Dennis Smith is after him, Jason Tatum, but are those three guys the clear cream of the crop?
I think so, but, you know, once you get past two, you know, Fultz and Ball, you know, I think that, you know, the difference between Jackson, Tatum, Smith, it's not gigantic. I mean, there's some wiggle room there still. You know, Tatum has come on very, very strong over, you know, the last few months of the season. He's a very, very talented guy. Exceptionally skilled offensively and, you know, can play, you know, multiple positions. So there's a lot of upside there with that kid. And so I think that he also has a lot to gain still. You know, the ACC tournament is going to be held in Brooklyn. I anticipate, you know, almost the entire NBA, you know, decision-making community being out here in New York to watch the ACC, the Big Ten in D.C., the Big East, which will be at Madison Square Garden, and the AAC at Hartford. You have four of the top seven conference tournaments here, you know, in the New York area within 3 hours driving distance. So I think Tatum also has a lot, you know, to gain. And, you know, Duke is, a lot of people think that they're going to win the national championship. So, you know, a good tournament run could help him quite a bit. And so I think that there's still a lot left to be decided over these next, you know, 3.5-4 months.
Yeah, I was going to ask you that a little bit later, but since you bring it up, the idea of a deep tournament run and success in that type of stretch. I mean, Tatum is a guy you just named, but are there other players that in this upcoming conference tournament and an NCAA tournament that you're kind of looking at and say, if this guy really puts something together, he could leapfrog up the board?
You know, my standard answer to that used to be that, you know, NBA teams, they look at a prospect's entire body of work and that, you know, it's their entire career that really matters and that every little bit of it is just another piece of the puzzle. It's another factor in the decision-making process and, you know, they're going to weigh that accordingly. But then you actually look at how the draft plays out, you know, and it's really not the case. You know, you look at Malachi Richardson, you know, go and have an unbelievable game in the NCAA tournament, you know, rockets into the first round off that. You know, you see a guy like, you know, Georgios Papagiannis go and, you know, make a couple of threes in a workout, and now he's a lottery pick all of a sudden.
Yeah.
You know, so I do think the draft is very, very fluid, and you know, what happened recently sticks in the minds of people, you know, whether they are willing to acknowledge that or not. So I do think that the guys that are going to get viewed the most are the ones that really have the chance to help themselves the most. And I think that if you look at the ACC, I mean, the GMs are going to be in Brooklyn at the Barclays Center to watch that. So all those prospects that are playing in that conference tournament really have a chance to help themselves. And I think a guy like John Collins, for example, from Wake Forest, who might not play in the NCAA tournament, but he's been putting up ridiculous numbers all season long. And if he goes and, you know, puts up a big fat, you know, 30 and 15 or something like that in front of 20 GMs, I mean, you can bet that there's going to be some lottery talk with him. You know, a guy that I wrote about today for the Vertical, Bruce Brown from Miami. If he goes and, you know, has a monster game against a North Carolina or someone like that, he's going to shoot up the board. So that's just the reality of the situation. That's just how the draft works. And, you know, especially with, you know, the trade deadline just having passed, GMs haven't really had a chance maybe to scout all these guys as much as they would have liked, especially some of these kind of late rising guys. And that's where, you know, some of these guys can really help themselves and rocket up the board here, you know, in March.
You know, a lot of people in Boston listen to this podcast, John, and, you know, that they're anxious to see what happens on lottery night with the Nets pick and if it goes number one. And, you know, a lot of questions with the point guards at the top. I mean, can either one of these point guards play alongside an Isaiah Thomas, who's the franchise player? Now, if Boston keeps the pick and if they draft somebody, you know, when you think about how Isaiah plays and Fultz and Ball, is one or the other better suited to play alongside a player like that?
You would say probably Fultz, just because he has, you know, more experience as an off guard and he has a little bit more length, you know, with that 6'10 wingspan, it's going to be easier for him to guard twos, which is really the challenge, you know, alongside a guy like Isaiah Thomas, who has improved significantly defensively, but he still has limitations size-wise. I mean, Lonzo has great size too. So, and you see him not having really an issue, you know, kind of dropping the ball off and playing off the ball, making spot-up jumpers. So I think either guy can do it. I don't know if it's going to be ideal, especially for a guy like Lonzo, who's so great with the ball in his hands. But listen, these guys are 18, 19-year-old rookies, and it's not like they're coming into the NBA ready to, you know, be all-stars from day one. It takes time to get your feet wet, especially playing at the level that Boston is, you know, competing for, you know, an NBA Finals appearance. I mean, these guys are not ready for that. I don't care how good, you know, you are as a 19-year-old. It's just, you're just not capable of doing that yet, unless you're a LeBron James type talent. I don't think these guys are. So it's going to be an interesting decision, but I mean, Boston just needs to take the best player and figure out later, because that's how you make mistakes in the draft. If you start thinking too much about, well, maybe, you know, this guy can fill a hole and play 15 minutes or 20 minutes or whatever. I mean, that's what Boston has always done, and I think they'll continue to do that. Just take the best player and figure it out later.
You've got 6 point guards in your top 10 right now, 4 from 4 to 10. I mean, putting aside Fultz and Ball there, I mean, is there some fluidity there? I mean, is Dennis Smith, is there a big gap between Dennis Smith and De'Aaron Fox and Malik Monk and some of these other guys you have on the board?
I don't think there is. I think that if you talk to all 30 teams, you know, they'll have these 6 point guards ranked differently. Mm-hmm. So, especially when you look at, you know, Ntilikina, you know, who's the last one on the board, some teams just absolutely love his size and positional versatility and ability to make spot up jumpers. And if you're looking to kind of put him next to a very ball dominant guard, you know, or, you know, a big point guard like a Ben Simmons type, I mean, he's the ideal guy to do that with. But I think there's that workouts are going to be really important. I know that these guys are not going to want to work out against each other, but if they are jockeying for a position, especially, you know, outside the top two, you know, Fultz and Ball are not going to do any workouts, then they're going to have to go up against each other in some of these places like Orlando, you know, LA, if they get to keep the pick, you know, Phoenix, Philly, Sacramento, the Knicks. I mean, all these teams are going to be looking for point guards, and they're going to cast a very wide net and try to figure out who's the best guy for us. And so going in and competing against, you know, each other is going to, I think that's going to maybe ultimately be what separates them.
How would you evaluate the strength of the European talent in this class? Every year we've got, you know, some top guys. You've got one or a couple in your lottery range. And of course, the second round, we get a lot of draft and stashes. I mean, the European talent as a whole, I mean, how would you evaluate it?
I think it's very down. Right now, we have two guys in the top 17, and then we have another one in 18, another one in 29. So it's four guys in the first round. That would be a very, very low number, you know, relative to previous years. And I think it's a reflection of, you know, just how many guys have been picked over the last, you know, two or three years. Especially last year was just a historic year for, you know, international players. And so I think that, you know, that tree has been picked quite a bit. And, you know, you have a very talented group of guys born in 1998 that are just now eligible to enter the draft. But it's such a strong year in college that I think you're going to see a lot of these younger guys maybe go back for another year, try again in 2018, 2019. And, you know, that pool needs to be replenished a little bit because it's not a great group right now.
You mentioned Duke and Jason Tatum and his chances of kind of continuing to rise up the board. And the flip side of that, you know, Harry Giles came into this season, you know, a lot of hype. I think he was, you know, in your lottery mix early on, and your current board has him all the way down at number 19. I mean, we knew the injury coming in was going to be a factor. Has it been a bigger factor than you expected, or has he just been disappointing as a player?
I mean, I think you have to talk about the injury. You know, I mean, he missed so much time. I mean, you missed two crucial years of your development in high school the way that he did. And then, you know, just as you're about to come back in the preseason, you have another surgery, and it really set him back. He wasn't able to step on the court until, you know, the middle end part of December. And so by that time, you know, he was already stuck behind, you know, a fifth year senior, a 23-year-old guy, and Emile Jefferson, who is, you know, every college coach's dream. And, you know, Harry Giles in today's basketball is strictly a center. So it's been hard for Duke to integrate him. You know, he only played 5 minutes last night against Florida State. You know, I don't know how much that's going to change here moving forward, and maybe in some of their, you know, their games against lesser teams in the ACC, he'll have more of a chance to step on the court. But he looks very tentative. You know, you could see the lack of experience. You could see the lack of confidence. And if someone picks him in the first round, it's not going to be based on anything they saw this year. It's going to be strictly based on, you know, maybe what they saw at the Under-19 World Championship, where, you know, which is 2 years ago, and very few NBA GMs were actually present there. So it's going to be very interesting. I mean, the word out of Duke is that 100% he's gone. I know there's some talk in the media that he should return, and that's, you know, that's not happening. So, you know, maybe he can show more in workouts. Those are going to be crucial for him, and it's going to be a real leap of faith. Maybe a team with multiple picks would decide to take him somewhere in that second half of the first round. But it hasn't looked great so far.
Why doesn't a guy like that want to come back, John? I mean, you'd figure if he had a full season of being completely healthy, that, you know, his draft stock could improve significantly next year.
Yeah, but the other side of the coin is he's already had three knee surgeries. You know, what's to tell you that he doesn't have a fourth one, you know, and then his career might be over? You know, at least in this scenario, he gets a guaranteed contract for 2 years, and he gets a chance to kind of work his way back on his terms. I mean, most agents and NBA decision makers will tell you that the second contract in the league is really what really matters. Nobody really remembers, you know, where some of these guys like, you know, Giannis, like Devin Booker, I mean, nobody remembers where they were picked right now. And so just go to the right organization. You know, falling outside the lottery could be good for him because it will go to a veteran team that, you know, can give him the very best treatment medically and just, you know, let him kind of come along slowly. And so it's just a big risk, you know, going back to school. I mean, I see the upside, you know, but just the downside is just so tremendous that it has to be scary.
Yeah, I mean, and along those same lines, for a team, I would imagine if you're looking at a guy who's had multiple knee surgeries, who did not play all that well in college basketball, that his slide, I mean, could his slide be even further? Could we see him potentially slide out of that first round?
No question. That's absolutely in play. He's going to have great workouts. The medicals are going to be huge for him. You know, he's going to go to Chicago to the NBA Combine, and he's going to have a doctor, you know, thoroughly examine every part of his body, and they're going to come to their own conclusions about, you know, what is the likelihood of you know, him re-injuring himself, you know, and they're going to want to figure out, you know, why has this guy suffered so much? I mean, there are some players who, you know, just are injury prone, and it's just nothing you can say. It's just a body type. And so those are going to be huge question marks. And if they don't get the right answers, there's no question that he's not guaranteed to be in the first round.
Couple of the veteran names that you have in the second round that I think people are interested in. Nigel Hayes from Wisconsin, finishing up a four-year career with the Badgers. You have him at 48 right now in that second round. Is he just a guy that's just too undersized to play or to be a higher draft pick?
I mean, I don't, in today's basketball, you know, with his length, he has, you know, like a 7'3", 7'4" wingspan. I mean, I don't think it's really the size that affects him. Even though he plays, you know, mostly small forward in college, I think in the NBA, he's going to be more of a four. It's been, you know, the lack of offensive improvement over the last 4 years, just the extreme lack of efficiency, the inability to make, you know, threes at any kind of consistent rate, even the inability to make free throws consistently. So you wonder what his, you know, offensive repertoire is going to be. How do you use him? You know, he's such a high character guy, and he's so intelligent off the floor. You think he's going to figure it out, but, you know, it's been 4 years now, and we haven't seen kind of that jump that you've been hoping for, and that's probably why he ends up in the second round.
And Dylan Brooks, a guy that's had a lot of success these last 3 years for Oregon, you've got him in the latter half of the second round. What's the knock on him right now?
Just the lack of length. You know, he's a guy with, you know, who measured a wingspan shorter than his height, and he plays the four primarily in college. There are a lot of question marks about, you know, whether he has that type of size and length to do that at the NBA level. But listen, he's making a very, very strong case for himself with just the season he's having, especially in the Pac-12. I mean, the guy has, you know, unbelievable self-confidence. He's made huge shots late in games. He's really, really improved. I mean, there are some question marks there defensively, and, you know, he kind of rubs people the wrong way with his demeanor at times, but he has a chance to really move up, you know, in March, I think. And he's a guy that's going to get looks in the first round, without a doubt.
There's always, not always, I guess, but there's often a guy in that second round that pans out. And a couple of years ago, the Nuggets drafted Nikola Jokic in the second round, and he's turned into somebody they believe is, you know, a true franchise player, a guy they're right now currently trying to build their team around. What were people missing out on? What was sort of unexpected about Jokic when he got to the NBA? Maybe something that he wasn't showing outside of the NBA that he suddenly, you know, did start showing once he got there.
I mean, he's such a unique player, just his style of play. It's so unconventional. There's nobody that you could really point to in the NBA and you can say, that's how this guy plays. And that's how the NBA scouting game kind of works, that you look at a player and you say, he reminds me of this guy, you know? And so you didn't have that with Jokic. I mean, he's just got this kind of doughy, flabby body. You know, he looks like he's 40. Even when he was 18, he could barely jump over a phone book. And you just wondered, I mean, how is this guy going to be able to handle himself defensively? And, you know, what we underestimated was just how intelligent of a basketball player he is. And I mean, also being in a phenomenal situation, you have to give credit to Denver. I mean, just really surrounding him with the right kind of pieces and using him and letting him, you know, be that facilitator offensively. I mean, he's such a great passer. And you know, I think that's the thing that gets lost sometimes in scouting is, you know, feel for the game, basketball IQ, just knowing how to play. You know, we, as the kind of the draft process moves on, we, you know, we get so enamored with, you know, length and athleticism and, you know, workouts and, you know, shooting in an empty gym and, you know, all these things that really don't matter as much when you actually step on the court. And so you can kind of forget about a guy like Jokic, who was, you know, tucked away in Serbia, very late bloomer, only played in one real FIBA tournament as a backup, you know, so he wasn't like Dario Saric or someone who was just hyped from age, you know, 15 or 16 as this, you know, great prospect. And so those guys can really sneak up on you. And I think it's a, you know, it's a learning experience for all of us, you know, and it's, you don't want to miss out on guys, but you know, it happens. And, but you have to give credit to Denver. I mean, they did an amazing job scouting him and evaluating him and putting him in a great situation to succeed.
Is there a guy out there, John, that's, you know, kind of fits that mold, somebody that you have some uncertainty about based on whether it's their physique or the league they play in right now overseas?
That's a great question. I wish I could answer that, because if there was, you know, he wouldn't be in my second round. I'd be, you know, shouting from the hills that this guy is, you know, the next whatever.
You mean, but you weren't shouting Jokic from the hills? I thought I remembered that. No? No, that was...
I mean, we like Jokic, but no, I can't tell you that I envisioned this. And... you know, I mean, Giannis is a guy that I think maybe we can take a little credit on, but not Jokic.
So nobody in that second round range European talent that's, you know, Giannis was interesting because the league he played in, right? I mean, it was such a mediocre league over in Greece that, you know, at least the GMs I talked to at the time, they couldn't seem to figure out just how good he was.
Yeah, I mean, he looked really good. And also we got to see him in other settings. We got to see him with the Greek national team and, you know, that tournament in Italy while we were all at the Euro camp. And, you know, I mean, yeah, I mean, he's another guy that he wasn't hyped, you know, earlier on in his career. And I think this happens to the Americans too, where if you aren't kind of anointed as a big time prospect, you have a bigger kind of obstacle to overcome in order to get drafted in the lottery or the top 10. You know, there's just a lot more skepticism around you, you know? So yeah. I mean, Giannis, the fact that he was in second division Greece wasn't ideal, but he was also the youngest player in the draft. So, you know, I think that people that went out there and really studied him, you know, they knew how good he was going to be, but, I don't think that the NBA still does a great job of, you know, going out and scouting international players. I mean, like, GMs will go and watch a guy play once, and if he has a good game, great. If he doesn't, I mean, it's tough because that's like really your one shot, you know. So it can be very hit or miss. Whereas here in the ACC, I have a guy like Jason Tatum, Dennis Smith. People watch him 10, 15, 20 times. They go to practices. I mean, they've seen him in the McDonald's game, in the Jordan game, in the Hoop Summit. So it's there's still a bit of a barrier there for the international players in terms of, you know, getting noticed, especially if you're as young as Giannis or Jokic was when he entered the draft.
Now, along those lines, what do teams put too much stock in when they're evaluating players? Is it the combine, how they perform there? Is it individual workouts? Is it the tests that they undergo? What's kind of an overrated scouting point?
I think the workouts, honestly, I think the workouts is, you know, 90% of what messes guys up. If the draft were held at the beginning of April, I think teams would have it a lot more accurately than they do, you know, because that's just that whole 2-month process. You forget everything that really matters about, you know, watching guys in games. And there's so many just like manipulative games that are played between the agents and the teams. And, you know, and there, it's so much, you know, nonsense on that really doesn't matter. And so that's where you get a guy like Papianis. You know, he does a 1-on-0 workout. All these NBA teams show up. He makes a bunch of threes in it, you know, even though he was never a 3-point shooter at any point in his life. And now he gets drafted in the lottery, you know? And so you really kind of wonder about that, you know? And then there's a lot of guys who badly mismanage their pre-draft process. They go to the wrong workout, so they don't work out at all, or they get out of shape, or and they slip, you know, and then it ends up turning out like, wow, he should have been drafted actually exactly where we thought he would have gone had, you know, we not done this whole ridiculous pre-draft process. So I think that is where teams kind of slip up, but I understand because they aren't really able to devote their full attention to the draft until their season ends, you know, and that doesn't happen until the middle of April. And that's kind of when, for a lot of front offices, that the light bulb switches on and they're going to full-time draft mode. And listen, if you're not working on the draft full-time every single day, you know, almost 24/7, you're going to miss out because it's a beast of a process. There's so many players, so many people to talk to. There's so much information to gather, so many different things to analyze that it's really challenging. And so, you know, April is when things really get going.
Yeah, yeah. It's going to be a busy month for everybody, busy month for you as well. John, I appreciate it, man. Thanks for taking some time to join me here on the podcast.
Thanks, Chris. Anytime.
That's it for this week's episode. My thanks to Bobby Marks and Jonathan Gavoni for joining the show. As always, you can download Archive Podcast on iTunes, TuneIn, Stitcher, really anywhere you can download podcast. While you're there, leave a comment, post a rating. You know I appreciate it. And I'll see you next week.
This has been a digital media production. Find your voice.